to the second case of the morning.
Rachel, you think your dad did a good job? I think she's nodding. Yes.
Second case is Woodhaven Homes Realty versus Holtz and Robbins. Okay, Mr. Terriman.
May it please the court.
Yes.
Learned counsel. Your Honors, I'd like to direct my remarks today to 3 points from the briefs. First deals with Section 505 and its application in this case. There are two lines of cases coming from the Seventh Circuit which I believe compel reversal in this case. The first line of cases begins with Gonzales. And the logical extension of Gonzales is a case called Assessment Technology Wisconsin versus Wire Data. At this time, I'd like to take a brief moment to apologize to both the court and counsel that pursuant to Rule 28, Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 28J, I filed today the citation with the court. I had an opportunity to get it to Mr. Dagan yesterday. It was found during our case of our updating the cases. It should have been cited by both counsel in our principal briefs. For that, I apologize. But I believe that Assessment Technology Wisconsin is not only an appropriate case, but directs the result in this particular case. As indicated, Gonzales started out the line of cases by indicating that parties for whom relief, financial relief, the economic relief at the end of the case is limited, should have a presumptive entitlement to attorney's fees under Section 505. Assessment Technology was the logical extension of that case. Assessment Technology recognized that defendants, by their very nature, are generally not going to be receiving the economic benefit at the end of the case. So that there was presumptive entitlement to defendants in copyright cases upon successful completion. I believe that that is a good rationale, a good extension of Gonzales, and applies with good force to this case. Because you have defendants similarly situated as the Robbins family of defendants in this case, who are faced with an option at the beginning of the case, like in any other case, regardless of whether it's copyright or any other case that comes before the court system. They have an economic determination to make, and that determination is to whether to proceed with the case to its logical conclusion or to accept an expedient compromise. However, in cases such as copyright cases, and in particular for an individual in a small corporation from a small community like Mr. Robbins from Waterford, Wisconsin, to accede to an offer of compromise which would require that company to agree that they had stolen someone else's plans would be disastrous. But yet, this defendant is faced, as again all defendants are, with the prospect of paying perhaps $100,000, $200,000 in defense of a case or taking the expedient. Assessment Technologies signals to defendants who are placed in that situation that if they have a meritorious defense, that there is a somewhat faded light at the end of the rainbow, that if they prosecute that defense to its logical, what for them is a logical conclusion, that they have the prospect of receiving at least a portion of their attorney's fees back. The second line of cases, which I believe compels the reversal, is actually a single case, and that's Budget Cinema. If we take the principles of Budget Cinema, and the first builder in Budget Cinema was Budget, and we change Budget's name from that case to Woodhaven, we take the first designer in that case of Budget Cinema, which was Arch Design, and we call that Pulte Home. We take the second designer out of Budget Cinema, that was Serretta, and we call that party Christensen Building Center. And finally, the builder, in fact, was Value Cinema. We changed that name to Robbins Electric Incorporated, we have the facts of this case almost identically, and to the extent that there are slight differentiations, those differentiations are more egregious and militate more in favor of the grant of 505. Unlike Budget Cinema, which was terminated on the first go-round, on the same facts, this case before the court today was dismissed, brought again against Robbins, was dismissed a second time on procedural grounds, on copyright procedural grounds, jurisdictional grounds. And for the third time, the Robbins family of defendants was brought kicking and screaming into the court and was ultimately dismissed on the merits. Also unlike Budget Cinema, and again more egregious, is that in this, at least in Budget Cinema, there was some privity between the principal builder, the first builder, and the first designer. In this case, there is no privity between the first builder, Woodhaven, and Pulte Home Design. Under the principles of stare decisis, I would ask that this court reaffirm its pronouncement in Budget Cinema and reverse this case and award attorney's fees. I'd like to turn my attention next to Section 1325. Section 1325 of the Copyright Act deserves some attention from the court system in general. There is a dearth of cases. Parties attempting to invoke Section 1325 face a catch-22 situation. On the one hand, from the face of the statute, courts can reasonably ask, what would the Copyright Office have done with these facts? Would they cancel this registration? And unfortunately, that is a meaningless and academic exercise because the Copyright Office does woefully little. If the court would sanction me, or if the court on its own would take the Pulte design themselves and change the name of the design and put its name under the author's name and submit that registration, I would submit to this court that registration would be granted and would clothe that registrant with the prima facie evidence of ownership. And there's nothing Pulte Home could do about it with regard to the Copyright Office. Unlike the patent system, which has an inter partes interference procedure, and unlike the Trademark Office, which has a cancellation procedure before the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board, there is no such inter-parties procedure within the Copyright Office. Moreover, the Copyright Office won't accept third-party complaints. So a person placed in a position such as a Pulte Home would be put in a position such that they would not, they would have to resort to the court system. So effectively, there's a somewhat of a paradox. The court, in determining whether 1325 should apply, will look to whether the Copyright Office would have canceled the registration. Yet the Copyright Office looks to the courts and says, we will cancel registration only when you tell us to. Excuse me. I would propose that this court establish a totality of the circumstances test, but that the totality of the circumstances be from the perspective of the litigation rather than from the perspective of the Copyright Office. That when applied to this case before you today, that there are certain things that happened in this case that would implicate the fraudulent nature and the reason for compensation under Section 1325.
Now, how much of this was, you know, the district court did a lot of work in this case.
Yes, sir.
Dismissed certain things. There's certain things that are not on appeal. And aren't we kind of confined to what's on appeal here, which is really the attorney's fees and not all of the issues about that really were litigated and, I guess, dismissed and not appealed?
Your Honor, they were pardon me, Your Honor. I believe they were appealed. They show up as not only an issue.
Well, the issue on why they should be attorney's fees, I guess, or why isn't that?
No, Your Honor. There was separate parts of the brief and separate part of the issues were directed toward the Section 505 compensation or denial thereof and to the separate grant under Section 1325. we recognized that this was a vehicle with appropriate facts that would allow the appellate courts to actually make some law that would guide litigants in the future. But yes, Your Honor, I believe it is appropriate on appeal, and I believe it is listed as one of the issues
right.
on
well,
appeal.
Well, it's kind of mixed up, but I want to clarify that there are certain things that are not, and that the district court did resolve certain things.
There are a number of things, a number of parts of the decision of the district court which are not subject to appeal, yes, Your Honor. But I believe this is properly before the court.
All right.
Pardon me. Here, there was to some degree a manufacturing of the authorship, and I think that was necessary for Woodhaven for objectively for a couple of reasons. First and foremost, Christensen Building Center, who was the author, and I use that word in quotes, and I've used it in the brief in quotes as well, because truly I don't believe they can be the author of a derivative work. Of a derivative work for which they had no license, at least as far as the copyright law is concerned. But for purposes of distinguishing who actually put this in a tangible medium, the party that put it in the tangible medium was Christensen Building Center, and they were not listed on the application. That was for a couple reasons. First and foremost is that Christensen Building Center has gone out of business. There is no entity that would be able to sign on behalf of Christensen Building Center because that had officially dissolved. In addition, the derived rights were not listed, I believe, for a couple of reasons as well. First and foremost is that the derivation of Pulte could not be disclosed as far as Woodhaven was concerned. Woodhaven had entered into a contract with the Parade of Homes for the 1998 Parade of Homes, and that contract required them, and they signed and agreed to, have an independently created original design. By having taken the Pulte design and used the Pulte design, they would have been in violation of that contract. Secondly, by choosing the short form versus the long form, and they should not have chosen the short form, they were able to evade a couple of the questions that would have been hurtful to them, and that is the derivation requirement. In addition, they would have had to have listed whether this was a work for hire and would have had to face that question. Instead, they chose a short form which is limited to individuals, not to corporations. It is, by its instructions, prohibited for use by corporations. I shouldn't say prohibited, but corporations are excluded from using it, but use that form nonetheless. And the Copyright Office, not knowing of any of the background, not knowing of the Pulte design, not knowing of Christensen Building Center's involvement, took the form and allowed that form to be processed, assuming the information on there had been correct. I would like to turn the attention, if I may, to these other appellants, to the Hotzes, and ask the court to be guided by the common law principles with regard to the American rule. The American rule, as unfortunately frequently stated, is frequently stated in its in an abbreviated form, that is, that parties bear their own costs. Of course, the full version is parties shall bear their own attorney's fees, absent three exceptions. Exceptions being if there's a statutory exception, if there is a contract between the parties, or alternatively in third-party litigation, which was caused by the acts of one of the parties, one of the two parties.
You know, this is so gummed up, it seems to me. The hold harmless agreement, you could have put attorney's fees in there, and it wasn't in there.
So correct, Your Honor.
That might knock everything out as far as the whole. But following up on Judge Mannion's question about what's not on appeal here, why do we have to be concerned about all this rigmarole about where the plans originally came from and that sort of stuff? I mean, there's no appeal. They lost in the district court, and it's found that their copyright was invalid.
Yes,
so why do we have to be concerned with all the details of it?
Well, actually, Your Honor, the copyright was not found to be invalid.
Well, their copyright infringement action against you was dismissed.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Different filing dates and all that sort of stuff. But why do we have to be concerned with any of that?
Your Honor, I believe that the trial court should have been concerned, and I'm asking this court to entertain this as well, and not only entertain it, but recognize it, that in the assessment technologies case, the guidance that I believe that is given in that case is given not only to the trial courts, but to the litigants as well.
Well, that's a good case for you. There's no doubt about that. But I just don't know how this case, how much was this house worth?
The house, I believe, had an approximate price of about $300,000.
I mean, there's already over $200,000 in attorney's fees.
Yes, Your Honor. In answer to the court's original question, why should the court be concerned with this? And my answer is that at the inception of this case, when a litigant, a defendant, has to decide whether to proceed, the defendant looks not only at the one issue that obviously he's looking prospectively. He can't divine what will be the final outcome in his favor. There, in this case, there were multiple defenses to this copyright action. Among them was the fact that the Robbins family defendants never copied the plans. That was just one among many. When a litigant is faced at the very inception of the case and he has five or six meritorious bases upon which the case can and should be dismissed, the fact that a court, perhaps through serendipity, perhaps through strategy, perhaps for whatever reason, ultimately ends up deciding the case on one of those, that doesn't make the fact that those others existed evaporate. What we're asking the court to do is we're asking the court to look at the totality of a totality of the circumstances, not in a necessarily legal sense, but more of a kind of generic sense. And that is that when we have a defendant who not only didn't copy the plans, but is being persecuted with plans that aren't the plans of the plaintiff, that the plaintiff, we believe, fraudulently obtained the registration that it did, that the plaintiff didn't accept, and there were attempts made to settle the matter early on, that when all of this fell through, that when the trial court is given the option to resolve the case and does ultimately resolve the case on a non-infringement basis, that all of the rest of this should not be irrelevant. That the manner in which the matter has been brought in the first instance and the manner in which the case not only is brought but prosecuted should be an important part of the determination. And I believe it is under Fogarty, because Fogarty asks the court to look at concepts not only of compensation but of deterrence. And if we only deter those portions of the action that led to the ultimate decision and ignore everything else which could have led to a decision equally as well.
Was it the findings of the district court that were an error just of his assessment of, how legitimate the case was and all that is wrong? Is it something we would have to re-examine and whatever his findings were as a trial judge were just an error?
I believe there are two bases to resolve this case. One would be to reverse it merely on the fact that the court applied the wrong standard of law because he didn't have the opportunity to have before him the guidance of assessment technologies, which was decided after his decision. That would be sufficient. I do believe that there were some of the findings were in error, and that there was an abuse of discretion in that the trial court was, I believe, hearkening back to the old dual standard days, pre-Fogarty, which was the law in the circuit, that required more than just a successful defense. I believe that the trial court was looking for more, and when the trial court, in a decision of finding of non-infringement, found that the trial court was satisfied that was where the inquiry should stop, and on that basis improperly denied the 505 fees. So, thank you, Your Honors.
Okay. Let's see, who's next? If you two. Are you Mr. Dagan? Okay.
Morning, Your Honors. I'm Brad Dagan, and I represent Woodhaven Homes in this case. As I was listening to the prior argument, I couldn't imagine how difficult that was or will be to decide that case, but I had almost started comparing it to the drive down from Milwaukee in rush hour traffic, but after listening to all the arguments, that the drive from Milwaukee in rush hour traffic does not compare to those issues. Similarly, in this case, there's a flurry of issues that must be decided by the court that I think are difficult, partly because of the volume of litigation that this case has produced.
Let me just ask you a couple of questions here, just trying to figure this thing out. But the Holtz has paid you $1,500 for these plans. Is that correct?
Well, actually, that's disputed, Your Honor. What the position of Woodhaven is, and we lay it out in our facts, is that the $1,500 was a down payment on a construction contract that was to be pursued. And there are a number of other documents and actions taken by Woodhaven in order to pursue the construction of this home. Woodhaven never intended to sell these people the plans, particularly for only $1,500.
Was there ever a finding about that?
No, Your Honor. There's never been a finding as to
that. I mean, that's their contention. They paid $1,500 for these plans, and I guess you made some modifications on the plans at their request.
That's correct.
But that's a disputed item?
That is a disputed item and was not decided by the lower court.
And you say what you did was just accept $1,500 from them as a down payment to go ahead and that you were going to build a house, and then they turned around and went to Robbins and they built the house.
My client never cashed that check. And there were a series of other activities, including application for building permits, repeated contact with the customer, and inquiries were made throughout the span of 1 year's time. Construction contract was drawn up, specifications were drawn up, bids were obtained from all of the subcontractors to come up with a price quote for this job, and my client was ready to start construction, but Holtz has said, no, we need to wait to resolve an issue relating to a barn we have on our property. But I think you've hit it on the head, though, Your Honor, in that this specific case really turns on a more narrow issue. We have litigated, I don't want to say litigated to death, but I hate to be melodramatic.
Well, pretty close to litigated to death. I think Judge Mannion's questions about can we be comfortable putting aside that we don't have to decide? I think we would all prefer to decide this on as narrow a basis as we can. Mm-hmm. And if the narrow basis is a narrow way to look at the case is that you drag them into court and ran up this incredible bill litigating everything in the case, and they end up winning at the end, at least under 505, are they entitled to attorney's fees against you?
I think that is too broad of a scope here. I think if we look at the focus of the two relevant decisions from July of 2003, those are decided on a more narrow basis. The first of the decisions denied attorney fees on the basis that sufficient detail was not provided. On motion for reconsideration that we presented, the lower court then said, well, wait a minute, you have not complied or established a claim under Section 505. Instead, you have failed to argue why you are entitled to attorney fees on the basis that you succeeded in this court. What we have here on appeal and in the trial court was an extraordinary amount of presentation from Robbins extraordinarily overzealous litigation that produced a wide flurry of factual aversions that were never proven at the trial court level. In fact, we had to go to great lengths to respond to those, preserving the record and such, and have done so in our appellate brief, and have matched every factual aversion point for point and demonstrated that we have not only a good basis but a very strong basis for success on those claims. Frankly, Your Honors, we chose not to appeal on our limited issue as to copying because we had run over our budget for litigation. We ran up approximately $40,000 of attorney fees on a $55,000 case. We settled with the homeowners, and so we said, enough is enough, let's cut our losses. Well, this now has turned to an extraordinary amount of litigation, which I think the Supreme Court has said on many occasions that litigation of attorney fees should not become a second major litigation or a third major litigation or a fourth major litigation, and that's what we have here. We have an extraordinary effort to collect attorney fees in a case that was decided on a very limited issue as to copying. We dispute and contest the copying component, but I think if you look on appeal, the case is cited by counsel. If you even examine in the Section 505 analysis, Assessment Technologies, Gonzalez, and Budget Cinema, those cases are far different than this case, judges. What we have in those cases are situations where the copyright law was abused. There was intentional infringement in Gonzalez. In Assessment Technologies, the party attempted to obtain a copyright over computer data for which no copyright could legitimately be obtained. Budget Cinema, if we look at the length and breadth of that opinion, there are numerous instances of an example where party filed suit without ownership, improperly used other works, misstated authorship, falsely represented that all copyrights had been purchased, and a number of other things, improperly sought statutory damages and actual attorney fees, and improperly sought treble damages in that case. I think what we are asking the court to do today is to focus more on the strict aspect of the discretion of the trial court and what was done in this case. But meanwhile, if you do examine the 505 analysis, it just doesn't apply to our set of facts. My client had a legitimate copyright. If we had gone to trial, I am quite confident we would have proven that he had properly obtained a copyright. One thing that's in our brief that I'm just going to highlight is there was one particular home that my client built in 1992, that the front facade of this home, except for a two-story foyer, is virtually the same as the Pulte home that was built 3 years later. My client is a high-end builder and has built homes that look like this for many, many years. So the fact that they had a two-story foyer that looked like the Pulte home is not enough to say you infringed on the Pulte copyright. And that's, you know, a whole slew of
blueprints effects that are important, the plans, not right. The end result.
Right.
You don't look at the house and say it's the same. You have to look at the plans.
Sure. And that's, I think if there were a comparison of the plans, and particularly an examination of the evolution of this design that resulted in the case built for Mr. and Mrs. Holtz, the court would have determined that my client did, in fact, independently create it and had been building homes just like this for 3 years before the Pulte home was ever built. I think there's some discussion of Section 1325 that I'd like to address. We're asking the court to review that on the basis of the clearly erroneous test, because the Section 1305 involves principles of intentional conduct with intent to defraud the Copyright Office and material affecting rights under the copyright laws. The trial court made an express finding, short and sweet, that there was no evidence in the record of a violation of Section 1325 and that Robbins was not able to prove intentional conduct on my client's part. As a result, we would ask that element of the trial court's decision be affirmed. Another key aspect here that has not been hit on so much is the counterclaim that was pursued and is another bootstrapping effort by Robbins to get attorney fees in this proceeding. In the October 2003 decision of the lower court, I think the trial judge carefully examined what was presented in the pleadings by Robbins and compared the affirmative defenses and the counterclaims and determined both on the basis of 12b-6 and Rule 8c, that there was no basis for the counterclaim to proceed where, in fact, the counterclaim was actually restated affirmative defenses. In this case, and on the basis of the record before you, I'm going to ask you to follow some of the reasoning we find in the cases, and particularly some of those in the Second Circuit, where claims for attorney fees are not awarded, where those claims have some merit and have some legal or factual basis. I think this goes back to the Section 505 analysis, and I think in our case we have set forth ample presentation in the brief of the facts that support our claim for a legitimate copyright and a legitimate basis for filing suit. We must remember Woodhaven had a valid copyright, at least on its face, subject to challenge, which was never decided by the lower court. But there, too, Robbins built a home from those plans. That's enough grounds, I submit, for us to file suit. In wrapping up, I would certainly invite any questions, but I think the objectively reasonable test is the one that must be looked at under Section 505 if you get to that issue. But again, I respectfully submit that, may I finish? I see my light is on. That under the decision, particularly the July 29th decision of the lower court, the court did explain its reasoning and did so in a thorough manner and decided the case on the narrow issue as set forth in its decision, that the basis for attorney fees was not the same basis that judgment was granted in the lower court. So thank you for your time.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Hudick.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Patrick Hudick. I represent the Holtzes in this case, who are the homeowners. All the claims between my clients, the homeowners, and the drawer of the plans, Woodhaven, have been dismissed. That's item 205 in the record. So therefore, we're not involved in any case involving Woodhaven. We are here now solely on the small hold harmless clause, which the ultimate builder, Robbins, submitted to my clients. We are not involved in any of the copyright infringement litigation. Therefore, I will keep my comments extremely brief because there is very little need to expand on the law or the facts beyond that set forth in Judge Randa's clear decision on pages 3 to 5.
I understand your argument on the hold harmless agreement, but just tell me where this, how this $1,500 was paid for the plans, even though that's not your issue. What does the record tell us about that?
The record is very simple. I have first-time home builders. What do? You go to the parade of homes. They're unsophisticated, non-contract, non-attorney folks. They see a house they like. They get the builder's card. They go over to Woodhaven and say, could you draw a couple lines here to change the porch and a room and whatnot? And they think about it. And they get a bid. The bid is very expensive. And so they say, well, how much can we compensate you for the plans? They had no contract with Woodhaven, none at all. This is just kind of a solicitation by Woodhaven. Here are some plans. You like them. Let's build. They never signed a contract.
So
it's the only reason they paid them.
Was it $1,500 paid as a down payment to build the house, or was it to purchase the plans?
To purchase the plans. That's the only facts in the record, and why counsel brought this up when we have no claims against each other, I don't know. They paid $1,500 for the plans.
Well, it makes their case a lot better. If they just sold you the plans, you'd probably have a right to do whatever you want.
Well, my unsophisticated first-time home buyers paid $1,500 for the plans. They had no contract with them. They went to another builder, and he said, fine, and they signed this little agreement. Can you just make sure that you own the plans? Yeah, we paid for them. And they signed that, the hold harmless. And the law is so clear on this issue, I'm somewhat disappointed practicing law for 25 years and coming before you on a non-fact, non-interesting legal case. And so unless there are any other questions, the record is real simple on my limited part of the case.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you so much.
You got a half minute or so. You got anything you want to wrap up with?
Thank you. Just a couple comments, if I may, to follow up. It's frustrating for us that
a wand of overzealousness can be waved, and we're supposed to be now cloaked with that. The case was dismissed several times for want of jurisdiction. I would be loath to wear a charge of Rambo-style lawyering. There was a outstanding discovery request that we propounded in there on July 3rd. We were trying to courteously resolve it for 3 months, and when the final analysis, we only brought a motion to compel in the final analysis when it was right before the depositions, discovery was closed, and we needed to have the documentary evidence before we questioned the witness. So again, thank you. I see my time has expired. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Okay, thanks. Thanks to both, all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.